This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
A joint advisory with the FBI has formally accused Beijing of attempting to steal COVID-19 research and data. What can you tell us about that threat? Is it all about a vaccine or is it broader than that?
You know, my concern here from a cyber security resilience perspective is these are sometimes organizations that are not Fortune 100, Fortune 500 with well-capitalized security teams and CIO and CISO shops. Some cases, they just don't have the same resources, and therefore, any sort of intrusion could be disruptive to the overall effort.
Is it just the Chinese or is it other governments as well?
You know, if you're not doing it, you're not trying. Kind of at this point, we do expect every intelligence service to be in the mix here. And that's kind of the thing about a pandemic, right? Is that it's not just one or two countries affected. It is truly a global event. So every country is experiencing COVID in different ways, but they're all experiencing. Campaigns have always been on the radar for foreign intelligence services. On the election side, the infrastructure side rather, again, we've got a better understanding and visibility across the landscape. We see on a daily basis just normal automated scanning, bad guys trying to do bad things. But in terms of this sort of coordinated, orchestrated activity that we saw in 16 against, you know, the Illinois voter registration database, we haven't really seen, you know, something at scale. We have better ability to see that. We've put additional hardening in place. We've messaged very clearly over the last 3.5 years. We've got to make sure that resilience is in place. So even if something bad does happen, A, we got the paper backups, right? That voters know what to do. Voters know that election night reporting is unofficial reporting. It's just as much about building the resilience of the people that participate in the voting process as it is about hardening the election systems themselves.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Chris Krebs is the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security. Prior to joining DHS in early 2017, Chris served as the director of cybersecurity policy at Microsoft. This is Chris's second tour working at the Department of Homeland Security. He previously served as a senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary for Infrastructure Protection, where he played a formative role in a number of DHS's programs. We just sat down with Chris to talk about the security of our election infrastructure as we approach the 2020 elections. Chris, welcome back to Intelligence Matters. It is good to have you on the show again.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So I'd love to start by having you remind our listeners, Chris, of the responsibilities of your agency, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA. Could you just give us a reminder on what you guys do? What are you responsible for?
Yeah, so founded in November 2018, part of the Department of Homeland Security. Effectively, we're the nation's risk advisor. So we work with the private sector across a range of critical infrastructure sectors to address both cyber and physical risks, and ultimately get the critical infrastructure of the United States in a much more resilient, hardened position. And of course, that includes a significant number of hot topics these days, including elections, but also helping secure the COVID response, the vaccine developers, the healthcare institutions, as well as working with any number of organizations as they kind of move into the digital transformation, making sure that they've got the insight and guidance they need to do it in a secure way.
Yeah, great transition, Chris, because while I want to spend a good chunk of time talking about election security, I do want to ask a couple of questions about COVID. And maybe the first one is, how is your agency handling keeping your employees safe? They're obviously essential and they have to work. So are you on shift work or can they work from home, or how are you guys handling that?
So, I mean, that is the kind of the question of the times, right? So we're actually 93% telework right now, about 2,500 employees, 93% telework. The majority of those folks that are working in an office environment are either in a SCIF, you know, classified space, or in an emergency operations center out in the state across the 50 states. We've had to kind of reduce footprint and introduce social distancing measures for those that are in the office. But we've been actually pleasantly surprised with the productivity for those folks that are telework or adopting this kind of remote work approach. I myself get in the office about once a week or so, and I've found honestly is as productive, if not more productive, than the pre-COVID, the old normal. But for those folks that we do in the office, again, social distancing, all the PPE, or at least cloth face coverings and disinfectants. But it's just, being smart about the times and not rushing back into it, really enjoying the ability to free up the workforce a little bit and really trying to understand what the post-COVID environment looks like, and can we keep this sort of telework posture and maybe save the American taxpayer a few bucks in terms of real estate and leases for office space.
Yeah. Have you been able to keep everybody safe so far?
We've of course had just the normal number of, I think, COVID infections across the workforce. But I think across the board, we've been pretty fortunate in terms of a safe and, healthy and hale team here at CISA. So again, we're looking to keep these best practices in place and following CDC guidance, of course, and following the lead of the various state and local health departments.
So Chris, you've issued guidance on how companies can help employees telework securely. Why did you take that step? Why did you do that?
So it was pretty clear to me early on, just even what we were doing as an organization, that a number of different, whether it's a company or a federal agency, was going through a pretty dramatic shift. There's a terrible joke that I tend to repeat, who was behind your digital transformation? Was it your CEO, your CTO, or COVID? And what we're finding is a lot of organizations have tried to make the shift over the last couple of years, but competing business priorities and other organizational commitments had really hindered that tech transformation. But COVID, man, really snapped folks too, and had to go to this remote operational environment. And that brings a whole lot of different security considerations, technology considerations. Do you have the appropriate tools in place, whether it's collaboration, how are you patching your VPNs, those things we've been banging on for years now. And so what we saw was a number of organizations, ourselves included, but also across the federal government, were issuing guidance. So we try to pull everything together into a one-stop shop. And the best place to go for that is cisa.gov/telework. But where we pull together our own stuff, NSA, NIST, and then private sector resources from the Global Cyber Alliance, Cyber Readiness Institute, even stuff from our international partners over in the UK. Just really trying to pull stuff together that there's one place to go to, whether it's, you know, the collaboration tools that folks are using. Here's how to deploy them in a secure way. And providing not just the CIOs and the CISOs, but the executives, the C-suite, the boards, the general counsels, the things they need to keep in mind is they're considering not just what today looks like, but, you know, the next year, 2 years.
So what are some of the key points that you think companies should think about as they work to secure all of this new telework and keep it safe?
Yeah, so it all goes back to what your vulnerability management approach looks like. How are you patching some of those critical appliances and virtual private network connections? We've seen the bad guys exploit it. We've issued some guidance over the last several months. Just VPNs are a target. And what we're seeing in some cases is organizations are not only, you know, they're not patching. In fact, they're moving away from VPNs and just direct connections to the cloud. But also, how are you maintaining your patch for your Windows machines, your Mac devices, and then multi-factor authentication across the board? You know, what can you do to really truly harden the identity management posture of an organization? Again, best place to go get the CISA stuff, cisa.gov/telework.
Chris, you've also issued a joint advisory with the FBI that has formerly accused Beijing of attempting to steal COVID-19 research and data. What can you tell us about that threat? Is it all about a vaccine or is it broader than that? How do you think about that?
Well, you know, you come at it from the top and you're like, so China's conducting cyber espionage? Color me surprised. You know, these are things that I think we've all expected. In fact, we've been talking about it for months. The first real product we put out. They predictably any foreign intelligence services can be trying to get an understanding of what other countries are doing, what their response is, what their approach to therapeutics may be and treatment going forward. You know, my concern here from a cyber security resilience perspective is these are sometimes organizations that are not Fortune 100, Fortune 500 with well capitalized security teams and CIO and CISO shops. Some cases they just don't have the same resources, and therefore any sort of intrusion could be disruptive to the overall effort. So this is much, much bigger than ransomware, but this is, you know, destabilizing networks, and it is focusing on, you know, from a, you know, confidentiality, integrity, availability triad perspective, the CIA triad. We're thinking, I'm focused significantly on, you know, maintaining the availability and maintaining the integrity of the systems and the information that's running across those systems.
Is it just the Chinese or is it other governments as well? I don't know to what extent
if you're not doing it, you're not trying. Kind of at this point, we do expect every intelligence service to be in the mix here. Chinese have obviously been one of the more brazen in terms of their approach, but others are in the game too. It's a very active space, very active space. And that's kind of the thing about a pandemic, right? Is that it's not just one or two countries affected. It is truly a global event. So everybody is, every country is experiencing COVID in different ways, but they're all experiencing it.
And Chris, is it all about espionage, right? Is it all about stealing information or is there concern? Is there any evidence that people are actually trying to do damage to the work that our research institutes are trying to do on the vaccine?
So when you roll up all the different threat actors, both state and non-state actors, you get both the intelligence, the espionage piece, but you also get destructive attacks. Absolutely. There, you know, the ransomware actors, you know, we, you know, kind of hoped against hope that there would be some honor among thieves. And what we found is even after some initial indications that particularly crews like the Maze ransomware guys had said, we're going to hold off. What we found after all is they did not. They were still exploiting the moment to go get their ransoms. Those attacks are absolutely destructive. They absolutely take organizations offline. You know, when you think back to WannaCry, when the National Health Service in the UK was disrupted, there were some significant impacts there. Now, this is on a global scale. So you're seeing a situation where a hospital could be impacted in their networks offline. They can't conduct clinical operations. It's not as easy as just transferring those patients to another hospital. Mm-hmm. In this environment, you never know what you're transferring, and do you even have anything you can transfer to? So we're absolutely seeing destructive attacks across the board right now.
So if anybody needs any reason to be reminded of the importance of cybersecurity, it's the fact that somebody could actually, you know, hold us back in terms of getting a vaccine to deal with this pandemic.
Yeah, and I think we've taken that approach previously for elections as well. I'm sure we'll get into that. You know, sometimes when you talk to election officials or you talk to healthcare officials, and you talk about Russia, you talk about China, you talk about North Korea and Iran, it doesn't always resonate with them. They may read about it, they may see it on the news, but they don't necessarily feel it. Ransomware is something that they intimately feel, whether it's their community or their peer networks. They see ransomware attacks on a regular basis. And if you can address a number of the key ransomware vectors, then you can actually close out a lot of the threats from some of those state actors. So we've really put a lot of emphasis behind ransomware in a number of different sectors.
So Chris, maybe just one more question before we get to election security, and it's sort of a 50,000 foot question. So if you step back from COVID, where are we today in terms of the government's and the private sector's preparedness for dealing with cyber attacks? How do you think about how far we've come and how far we still need to go?
So just today, we issued a series of products, a toolkit called Cyber Essentials Toolkit. It builds on a product we issued last fall. And really the concept here is the CISO community has, the IT security community has an overwhelm, you know, an abundance of guidance. They're good. What we have to continue focusing in on are the people that make the decisions that enable the actions of the IT security community. And that's the C-suite, that's the boards of the directors, that's the general counselors, the business side folks, underserved community. So we're putting a lot of focus on higher level executive, that community. Why is that important? Because it starts at the top. It's always about leadership. The more leadership understands, the more they understand the business risk, which then leads to the investment. And the investment then leads to, you know, opening up the floodgates for the CISO community to make the right, you know, to get those investments in place for the capabilities. So I think back a couple years ago to the RSA conference, and the theme was better. And that was kind of the feeling is like, hey, things are better than they were a couple years ago. Still a long way to go, but we're getting better. It's the awareness at the leadership levels is really opening up the investment channel so we can build out those capabilities. And I think across the board, you see that. You see that there's more awareness of the need to take the right steps on cybersecurity. And I think COVID right now is just going to accelerate through the digital transformation, accelerate investment in cybersecurity capabilities. And you know, there may be a market consolidation in the meantime, but so we're absolutely headed in the right direction on the defense side.
So election security. So how do you assess the threat landscape today as it pertains to foreign interference in the elections? How do you think about the threat that we are facing and are going to face as we get closer to November?
Yeah, so I always like the framing of the intelligence community assessment in 2017 that had three primary buckets. It was the technical targeting of election infrastructure. The second was the hack and leak campaigns or activities focusing on the political organizations, trying to get sensitive information and some cases, oppo research. And the third is just the broader destabilizing influence operations, trying to just undermine public confidence and create chaos. Those are absolutely three active areas or domains of activity by a range of actors, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and others that are unattributed at this point. Everybody has their own different strategic objectives. I tend to think that we have put in place a, around that first area, that election infrastructure space, we put a number of security improvements in place, resilience improvements. We've built these relationships across the country with the election officials, secretaries of state. We work with pretty much every single one of them. We work with over 6,000 election jurisdictions. We have intrusion detection systems across all 50 states and their election systems right now. We have mechanisms to share threat intelligence. We do annual exercises. Everything is in place right now, much, much better posture than we were in 2016. And that's just because, you know, there was this Sputnik moment that we just woke up and said, wow, you can destabilize a democracy through these sorts of efforts. So I think we're in a much, much better position from a resilience perspective on the election infrastructure side. Same goes, I think, with the hack and leak. Campaigns are more aware of it. There are ways on the private sector side where Microsoft, Google, a bunch of nonprofits have gotten together and they're offering, and they've gotten from that Federal Election Commission some ability to provide services at low or no cost. And then on the disinfo side, I think that's really the more complex aspect of this. It's just a psychological operations, psychological warfare. How are they getting into our heads, hacking our brains? We've said before, trying to get us to lose confidence in our, you know, our entire system, this American experiment. And we're not alone here. You talk to our counterparts in Europe, and throughout the world, this is the new normal.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Chris Krebs.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So, Chris, have we actually seen successful penetrations of campaigns or any related institutions, or just so far attempts?
So in terms of that, so again, breaking it up into the election infrastructure and then the campaigns, this is one of those things where campaigns have always been on the radar for foreign intelligence services. This is just, it's policymaking. They want to be on the inside. They want to know what the campaigns are thinking, what the candidates are thinking, where they're going to go. So countries can start, our adversaries in particular can understand what the next regime or administration might be thinking. That is active space. On the election side, the infrastructure side, rather, again, we've got a better understanding and visibility across the landscape. We see on a daily basis just normal automated scanning, bad guys trying to do bad things, taking advantage of, being opportunistic, basically. But in terms of this sort of coordinated, orchestrated activity that we saw in 16 against, the Illinois voter registration database, for instance, we haven't really seen, something at scale. We have better ability to see that. We've put additional hardening in place. We've messaged very clearly over the last 3.5 years about that sort of activity. So we think there's a good combination of deterrence by cost imposition and deterrence by denial in place that will continue to push off that sort of activity. But we're not taking that for granted. We are actively looking for it over there. Our intelligence community partners are actively looking for it. And we are actively monitoring systems here to stay ahead of it. But most importantly, we've got to make sure that resilience is in place. So even if something bad does happen, A, we got the paper backups, right? That voters know what to do. Voters know that election night reporting is unofficial reporting. It takes time to get that final certified result. Again, it's just as much about building the resilience of the people that participate in the voting process as it is about hardening the election systems themselves.
So will all the states have permanent paper record for the 2020 vote?
So in the 2016 election, it was about 80-82% of votes cast in the country had a paper record associated with them. And that's whether it's automatically generated or it's kind of a sidecar or it's a absentee ballot. By the time, and I have not adjusted the numbers for some of the states that are shifting to absentee ballots or mail-in voting because of COVID. But what we would expect is somewhere on the order of about 92% of votes cast will have that paper record associated with it. And that is a good chunk of the country. That's a good chunk of the competitive states as well from a policy or political side. There are absolutely some states that are going to be in a tough spot in terms of not having paper, and they have invested in additional security controls, monitoring, hardening their systems. New Jersey's the best example just yet. They don't have the resources, funding required right now to get there, but they have been investing in the cyber side. We work really closely with New Jersey on a number of the things they're putting in place. So, significantly, dramatically better posture than we were. And, on that note, one thing I'll add is that a lot of these systems that we're concerned about, that equipment you interface with on a voting day, you might find in some states that they're out of the system just because of, they're out of the process just because of COVID, because states are making shifts to vote by mail or absentee voting. So again, this COVID in some cases is actually cleaning up some of the lingering vulnerabilities in the system.
So Chris, did you all learn anything in particular from the Iowa caucus smartphone app incident?
Oh yeah. I mean, there are a bunch of things to take away here. I think first and foremost is just from a non-technical side, more of a kind of incident response side is whether you're a political party, you're a state organization, you've got to have an incident response plan. You have to know what you're going to tell the public, what you're going to tell the parties. You have to have a rapid response mechanism to get your arms around the problem and then clearly and confidently communicate to the public what's going on. The second piece is, and I already touched on a little bit, is that unofficial voting, or the unofficial results rather, we've got to reinforce that these official results, the certification of the vote, takes time. It's in many cases going to be weeks. It's not that night. So not jumping on to some of the issues that may pop up. But then also, we've been kind of on board, and we issued some guidance a couple weeks ago that took a look at internet-based voting, whether it's an app or whatever. We said, look, there's a higher degree of risk here just because of the systems you're using and the protocols that are supporting the process. We really would encourage you to have a physical ballot associated with the vote rather than, again, relying on the electrons. And I think that just is supported, again, by what we saw in Iowa. The National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Mathematics had a report on this about a year and a half ago that just said Internet voting is not ready for prime time. Too many issues still remain in just the overarching security protocols.
Yeah. So Chris, you talked earlier about the foreign focus from an intelligence collection perspective on the campaigns. I'm sure the same is true of the RNC and DNC. How do they think about securing themselves? Is it a top priority for them? Are they paying attention to it? Do they understand the vulnerabilities? Are you able to help them or not? How does all of that work?
Yeah, so we have been engaged with both the RNC and the DNC for a number of years now, predating, in fact, at least in my time here, predating the 2018 midterms, and have found really good uptake and partnership with us and transparency. We have seen them embrace cybersecurity and embrace protecting their systems. I think they, again, like I said, with some of the private sector technology solutions provided, given a break by the FEC that allows them to provide services. Because when you think about a campaign, if you've got a dollar to spend, anything spent on internal security is something that's going away from raising the campaign's profile. So the ability to provide those services at low or no cost is a game changer. But again, RNC and DNC both have been all aboard. Campaigns have been all aboard. We've met with both the Trump and the Biden campaigns, providing us a range of offerings on our cybersecurity services.
Chris, there's been a lot of discussion about the security of absentee and mail-in ballots. And I'm just wondering, from the perspective of the kinds of things that CISA is paid to worry about, is there anything special with regard to mail-in or absentee ballots?
So the thing we got to separate here is the systems from the process. The president's concerned about the process. From a systems perspective, we're looking at those infrastructure aspects that facilitate the execution of the process. And what I mean by that is, what systems are required to design a mail-in ballot, to print it, to receive it, scan it, tabulate it? Those are the things that we're focused on from a cybersecurity perspective. So, you know, early on in COVID, it was funny because, again, I come back to the RSA conference. We were working with our state and local election officials back in early or mid to late February, thinking through, okay, how are we going to keep in-person voting safe and sanitized and you know, people that can come in and out? It was things like have enough pencils, have a disinfectant, things like that. And then over time, we saw as the pandemic grew, there was a shift of a number of states saying, you know what, maybe we should not have people come in. We can use some of the other authorities that they have available to them. And that's where we saw this move again towards mail-in ballots. But again, they didn't necessarily have the systems in place. So they rapidly acquiring the systems. We're providing guidance and recommendations on how to control that, but at the same time recognize that not everybody's going to be shifting to mail-ins, that that states still provide for in-person voting. So how do we provide them guidance on both these alternative approaches to voting, which in many states are not the alternatives. It is, you know, Oregon, 100%, almost 100% mail-in. We have to address both the mail-in side as well as the in-person side in this, you know, time of COVID.
So let me ask you kind of an unfair question here, but in terms of everything that you're asked to do with regard to election security, do you have everything you need in terms of both the resources and the authorities to do your job?
So, I mean, this is a good question on the authority side. You know, one of the examples that I like to use is early in the administration, there was conversation about shifting some of the Article 1, Section 4 requirements that federal government takes a stronger hand in administering federal elections and regulating certain aspects. I'm a middle child, so I see compromise in coalition building where I can. And I've always found that, you know, honey is going to get you the flies a little bit easier. And we spent a lot of time early on in the administration building relationships. We had absolute missteps. We misfired right out of the gate. But I think we got our feet back under us. We committed ourselves to election security and supporting our state locals. And rather than taking an overly, you know, burdensome regulatory approach where we would have found ourselves in court like that, we said, let's work through this together. Tell us what your problems are. Tell us where we're screwed up and we haven't fixed this. You know, we haven't provided the things you need. And that's what got us to where we are today, where we're working with over 6,000 jurisdictions. We've got all 50 states as a member of the multi-state ISAC that shares threat intelligence, that shares them best practices. We've got Albert sensors out there on all 50 states. Like, those are the things that I can point to as real significant progress and validation that we took the right approach. Now, resources you know, I think Congress has always been has been pretty generous to us, but in some cases, there's just nothing better than good people out there, boots on the ground. I think in the run up to the 2018 election, I had over in the month of October running up, I had 500 people across the organization that were engaging in election security. That's you know, same thing we're gonna be doing in the run up to the 2020. It's people. So really getting people that understand how elections work, that understand how to talk to election officials, and tailor solutions to their requirements. That's where I put a lot of the focus.
So Chris, you talked about that third bucket, right? That foreign disinformation bucket, you know, via social media or different ways, and how it relates to the election. Is that something that you all play a role in, or is that somebody else's responsibility?
Michael, I'm disappointed in the question because that means that you have not seen the War on Pineapple campaign that we launched last summer.
I haven't.
So here's kind of how, at least it's CISA, that we view the disinformation side problem. It's almost a supply and demand issue. So on the supply side, what we're seeing is other parts of the federal government, you know, between the intelligence community, law enforcement, some of the Title X actors are actively out there trying to disrupt the supply of disinformation from our adversaries. But the companies are also involved in this. You've seen a number of inauthentic account activity disruption from the platforms. We're on the other side of that, though. I don't have those authorities, right? I'm the convener. I bring people together. We can help facilitate that by sharing information between state and locals and the social medias. When our state and local partners see disinfo activity, they can share it through us back to the platforms. We're focused on that. We're on the demand side. We're trying to increase the awareness of this problem set. We have been working with state and local officials, election officials, on the Trusted Info 2020 campaign, because that's what's going to happen. When we run up to the 2020 election, voters need to know where they can go get authoritative information on how to vote in their state. What better place to go than the state senior election officials, the Secretary of State or the state election director? Trusted Info 2020 is all about pointing people to those election officials to get info on where to vote, how to vote, and when to vote.
So, Chris, you've been great with your time. Let me just ask you one more question. We had Laura Rosenberger from the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund on our show last week. I think you probably know her. She painted for us a picture of her nightmare scenario, which was, you know, many, many more mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, which could take us longer in getting to a winner, you know, take us beyond election night to get a winner. And then you mix in with that some Russian tampering with election systems, not necessarily to do any damage or to change any counts, but just to sow confusion and distrust, and then throw some Russian info ops on top of that, in terms of this is a failed election, right? The Americans couldn't get this right. There was a high degree of fraud. And, you know, all of that is a mix towards raising Americans' questions about how did the election go. And that has a kind of a feel of realism to me. And my question is not, how do you prevent that from happening? My question is, how do we build resilience with American citizens not to fall for such a Russian kind of trap? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, and the thing I think we need to get our minds around is things have changed since 16. It's not just Russia. They put the playbook out there. Any country that doesn't quite like the way the American experience is going is going to get involved here, or could get involved. But back to the, you know, increasing the resilience, I think there's two or three things we need to do. First is continue to point voters to that trusted information, as I just talked about, the Trusted Info 2020 campaign. You know, go to your state and local election officials. They're the ones that are going to tell you what the real deal is, when, where, and how to vote, and then what the results are. And the second piece is really reinforcing Election night reporting is unofficial. And so it's on us to work with the media. And we did some tabletop exercises in the run up to 2018. We'll do it again for 2020. This is how things are going to work in the run up to that day in November. And then lastly, reinforcing that we take this seriously. We're protecting these networks. And this is a all of government. This isn't CISA, just CISA out here on our, all by ourselves trying to protect these systems. You have the entirety of the federal government behind this effort here and working over there. So I've got great partners in the intelligence community with Ann Neuberger at NSA, General Nocksoni, and his team over at Cyber Command. I've got the FBI. We've got the Election Assistance Commission that's helping get the funds out to our state and local partners. But this is something that I've taken on as one of my top priorities, really since day one since I came into this job. And I'm not walking away from it. We're going to be here, and we're gonna fight through the end on this one.
Chris, thank you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule. I really appreciate it. And so do my listeners. Thank you. That was Chris Krebs. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
This has been the Intelligence Matters Podcast with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morrell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. The podcast is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, and Jake Rosen. If you haven't already, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you download podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Intel Matters Pod and follow Michael at Michael J. Morrell. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News Radio.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.